The views and opinions expressed on Gaza Corner are those of me, Dori Stein, and our guests, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of KALW Public Media. Israel may have gone a step too far in the September 16th Doha bombing in Qatar. Gazan political analyst and writer Mohammed Shihada, on the day of the bombing, was interviewed on Drop Site News and explained why Hamas believed Doha was a safe place for ceasefire negotiations.
I was there when Trump asked Qatar to bring them all back to Doha again. The entire leadership were re-invited to Doha in early December. So basically, Hamas for this whole time were told that operating in Doha, a political office, a mediation office, is coming with a solid guarantee that Israel would never attack you here. This was an American-Israeli guarantee in the first place. And what you see Netanyahu doing is doing three things simultaneously: ensuring the destruction of the annihilation of the largest urban space in the Gaza Strip, Gaza City at the moment, and at the same time attacking any solidarity activists in those flotilla that are trying to prevent the physical destruction, the annihilation of Gaza City, and attacking any diplomatic prospect for saving Gaza City from full annihilation. So he managed to do this outstandingly today, bringing the negotiations to a halt. Qatar announced that it would suspend its role. And there's no incentive for Hamas to be there anymore and engage in those talks when they're just there in a death trap.
Gazan political analyst and writer Mohammed Shihada on Drop Site News. Israel is drunk with power. In addition to the ongoing Palestinian Holocaust in Gaza, it's daily ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. It has also bombed five countries in the last month alone: Syria, Qatar, Tunisia, Lebanon, and Yemen, including earlier today, 25 journalists were killed in Israeli airstrikes on two newspaper offices in Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. Add Iran if you go back to June. All were accomplished with absolute impunity. Israel used to stay silent about its bombing exploits, but now has become so brazen that it boasts about bombing other countries and assassinating whomever they want. After all, Trump is on their side, and he's the most pro-Israel U.S. president in history. But Trump does not have an ideological bone in his body. He views most everything through a transactional lens. And after the Qatar bombing, Trump cannot take his massive financial Gulf state patrons for granted. The only reason they do mega money deals with the United States is to receive ironclad guarantees of U.S. protection and security. And that just went out the window. Here again is Gazan political analyst and writer Mohammed Shihada, from the same Drop Site News interview.
The U.S. just sent a message to its key allies all around the world that nothing is going to protect you, no matter how much U.S. weaponry you buy or how much we invest in U.S. territory or U.S. industries or how much American troops you put on your ground. None of it will shield you from Israel. Israel is above and beyond anything, and it's bound by nothing.
Gazan political analyst and writer Mohammed Shihada. Netanyahu's bombing missed hitting the intended target, Hamas's political leadership, although Hamas said five of its members were killed, including the son of its exiled Gaza chief and top negotiator, Khalil al-Hayya. Also, a Qatari security person was killed in the blast. I believe Hamas's political leadership will find a new country to host and protect them. I think the likely possibilities are Turkey, Russia, conceivably China. Iran, I don't think so. It cannot offer the protection needed, in my view. Here's a scenario to ponder, as far-fetched as it may seem, although everything is conceivable in this dystopian world. What if the Hamas political leadership relocates to Turkey, and Israel, which is not bound by any red lines or international law, attempts to assassinate them with an airstrike or a bombing of some kind. Turkey could invoke Article 5, which stipulates that if a NATO ally is the victim of an armed attack, each and every other member of the alliance will consider this act of violence as an armed attack against all members and will take the actions it deems necessary to assist the ally attacked. Do you really think if Turkey invokes Article 5, NATO countries would use armed force against Israel? I doubt it, but it is food for thought. So now for part two of Gaza Corner, I'd like to welcome Miranda Cleland, who is the advocacy officer with Defense for Children International Palestine, known as TCI-P.org. We'll just say DCIP. Is that okay, Miranda?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay, so Defense for Children International Palestine is DCIP, and it's DCI-Palestine.org, the website. And let me get this disclaimer out of the way. Every year, I donate to quite a few organizations based in Palestine, and DCIP is one of them. So before we get into exactly why I invited you, let the folks know about the mission and the work of DCIP.
DCIP is the only local Palestinian human rights organization focused exclusively on the rights of children. DCIP was founded in the early 90s, initially to provide legal aid to Palestinian children who have been detained and prosecuted in Israel's military court system. And then during the Second Intifada in the early 2000s, DCIP expanded and added a documentation unit and began doing advocacy to sort of grow into a full-fledged human rights organization. We're still providing legal aid to children who are in the prisons, and that's what we're here to talk about today.
And tell us about where in Palestine DCIP has offices or headquarters.
DCIP is headquartered in Ramallah in the central occupied West Bank. We have field offices in Nablus in the north, Hebron to the south, and then currently we have four field researchers in Gaza. I'll start with Gaza. So for really almost two decades, we had one field researcher in Gaza. His name is Mohammed. And basically from the mid-2000s onward, he was in charge of documenting every single child fatality in the Gaza Strip, even throughout some of the larger military offensives, including the summer of 2014, he was able to do it. You know, sometimes hire a freelancer or two to help him. But during that time, we really felt confident that we were getting the full picture of what was happening in Gaza and that our team was able to do that. Mohammed is from Jabalia in North Gaza. And I remember those first couple of days after October 7th in 2023, Mohammed sent us details on, I think it was about the first 100 child fatalities in Gaza. And I remember thinking, this is so many more than we've ever had to deal with in such a short amount of time. And then I think it was October 10th or 11th, he sent us a message and he said, I had to move my family four times yesterday. I can't do this right now. Mm. And, you know, I say family, I'm not just talking about his wife and right. his four children. I'm talking about his elderly parents and his brothers and their wives and their children. And he was really trying to navigate, you know, somewhere around 30 people to safety. And of course, there is no safety in Gaza. So he actually has made it to Egypt now with his wife and children. They've been in Cairo for a little over a year. But since then, we've brought on four new field researchers who are spread from north to south in Gaza, and they are all doing exceptional work in really extraordinary circumstances and documenting some of the worst, most severe cases of child torture and starvation that we've ever seen as a human rights organization. The situation as a whole is very different than what we are used to compared to prior to October 7th, because We used to be able to say with confidence that X number of children were killed by Israeli forces during this time period in this area. And now our researchers are documenting, and I'll say that every human rights organization is in this same situation. Everybody is documenting as much as they can, but it is just the scale and the speed of the genocide in Gaza has made it impossible to get a complete picture of exactly, and we in our case as an organization, we're just looking at children, so people under the age of 18, and it's just impossible to know exactly how many children are suffering from malnutrition, or exactly how many children have suffered a limb amputation, or have been killed, or the list kind of goes on. And we have an idea based on how much we've been able to do and where we've been able to do it. I think a lot about the big picture of the story of this genocide, and I think it will be many, many years until I think we really understand the actual impact of what's happening right now.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about an impossible job. Impossible. In the interest of time, let's move to the report that DCIP put out, and that is again Defense for Children International Palestine. That really caught my eye, and I'd like you to give me the takeaways, the key takeaways from the report. The headline is 41% of Palestinian child detainees have no charges. Which to me, I would describe that as being hostages. Although the corporate media never uses that term for Palestinians held in administrative detention, which you can explain what that is. The corporate media focuses mainly on the 20 or so hostages Israel believes are still alive. But when Palestinians are seemingly arbitrarily detained without charge, why is that not a hostage?
Yeah, so I'll talk a little bit about that report, both sort of the meaning of administrative detention and then the meaning of this sort of new data that we have on child detainees with no charges. So administrative detention is quite an old practice that was actually brought to the region during the British Mandate of Palestine by the British. It is a tactic that was used by the British in Ireland. And when I visited Ireland, everybody immediately knew what I was talking about, except there it was called internment. Administrative detention is simply a form of detention without charges or trial, where the detainee basically can be held indefinitely with sort of no idea when they'll be released. So, under Israeli military law, how this works is an Israeli military commander will issue an administrative detention order, usually for somewhere between 3 and 6 months. And then that child or adult, because this is a practice that's used on both Palestinian adults and children, they will be held on so-called secret evidence that's not disclosed to their lawyer, not disclosed to their family, it's not disclosed to the detainee. And basically, they're just held in prison indefinitely.
And we're talking, it can be years.
Yes, it can be years, and we've documented cases where it has been years, even in the case of children. And when I say children who've been detained by the Israeli military, I'm usually talking about they're almost all boys, and they're between the ages of 12 and 17 years old. The age of criminal responsibility under Israeli military law is 12. However, the youngest administrative detainee we've documented has been 14 years old. Most of these are boys on sort of the older side of that, 15, 16, 17. I want to talk about this sort of new batch of data that we received. So the Israel Prison Service is the Israeli organization that administers the prisons throughout Israel, and they release prisoner data typically on a quarterly basis. And what that looks like is at the end of every month, they'll do a head count and basically count up how many prisoners they have. They do some sort of basic data analysis of ages, charges, are they in pretrial detention since bail is basically non-existent in the Israeli military detention system. So everybody is held in pretrial detention if someone is serving a sentence or if they're under administrative detention. So this is information that just applies to Israeli prisons. And that's important because we know that the Israeli military is holding Palestinians in other locations, such as Sde Taiman military base in southern Israel, where captives from Gaza have been taken. But there's no data available on those prisoners and those detainees.
And also,
So,
what are interrogation centers that also there as well, right?
yes, absolutely. So, yeah, interrogation centers are also not included in this data. So this data that we have, which is really the only data that's available, only applies to the actual prisons that are administered by the Israel Prison Service. And so what was included in their latest release of the data, which I'll note was about 2 months later than it should have been, that as of the end of June, out of all Palestinian children who are held in Israeli prisons, 41% of them were in administrative detention with no charges and no trial. And that is the highest we have ever seen by far. Both the raw number and the proportion of children in administrative detention has only climbed since October 7th to rates that we simply have not seen before.
I read it was 147 children right now in administrative detention.
Yes. The month before October 7th, 2023, I think there were It was 13 or 14% of all Palestinian child detainees were in administrative detention. So we can see that the Israelis have really expanded their use of this particular type of detention, which really serves as a method to exert control over Palestinians. And we know that both administrative detention and military detention as a whole has a really profound impact on children, whether they are detained for a few days or a few months or even a few years. A lot of children have difficulties reintegrating into their communities after they've been released. A lot of children end up dropping out of school because they've fallen too far behind and it's just too hard to catch up or to go back to school. And a lot of children suffer from ongoing anxiety, depression, PTSD, all kinds of issues that really last for quite a long time into their adulthood after experiencing detention.
Talk about how much worse the conditions, and the conditions were always bad, but how much worse the conditions are for the children in terms of overcrowding, in terms of starvation diet and medical neglect, and also the fact that even families are not even allowed to visit anymore.
Yeah, so after October 7th, the Israeli authorities implemented a number of pretty harsh restrictions targeting prisoners, including the complete suspension of family visits. So, no family member has been able to visit any Palestinian prisoner since October 7th. It's become much more difficult for lawyers, including our lawyers, to visit their clients in the prisons. Israeli authorities frequently reschedule those visits at the last moment or say, "You can come in, but you only have 5 minutes with your client," which, of course, we know is not enough time to provide adequate legal advice or other care. So much of the documentation we've been able to do has been from children who have been released from prison in this time, which, again, similar to what I was talking about with Gaza, is prior to October 7th, we were used to collecting over 100 cases a year that documented children's experience in the Israeli military detention system. And it's been much, much more difficult to do that since October 7th. The children that we have been able to talk to have reported that cells are extremely overcrowded, that twice as many children are in there that are supposed to be. Israeli soldiers frequently unleash really brutal beatdowns. And one major point has been that Israeli guards are not providing prisoners with adequate food. That includes both not enough food and the quality of food. Many of the children have told us that food is just rotten. You know, there'll be only a couple of spoonfuls of it, and whatever they get is rotten. And so I want to tell you about a case we had earlier this year in March of Walid Ahmed, who was 17 years old. And as of March, he had been detained for about 6 months. And he was the first case that we've ever documented where a Palestinian child has died in an Israeli prison. We are pretty sure that this is the only case of a Palestinian child dying in an Israeli prison since the occupation in 1967. So in Walid's case, we received a copy of the autopsy notes from a doctor that attended the autopsy on behalf of the family. And they described that Walid was completely emaciated. He basically had no fat left on his body. His muscles were wasting away. He had a lot of fluid buildup in his chest cavity, which is consistent with enduring regular beatings by Israeli soldiers and is consistent with ongoing prolonged malnutrition. Walid also had scabies, which has become increasingly common in really overcrowded Israeli prison cells.
They don't even give him shampoo. I mean, they can't really
Right.
wash
Yeah,
him.
yeah. Absolutely. He had sought medical care multiple times from the prison doctor, who basically gave him a Tylenol and sent him on his way. And finally, what happened in March was Walid collapsed in the prison yard and he hit his head on a rail. And the other child detainees called over for a guard to come and help him. And by the time he got any medical care, he was gone. In essence, Walid was starved to death in Israeli prison. And the fact that something like this could happen in 2025, and it barely, I feel like I still felt like I was fighting to get the news or anybody to care, was really, really alarming. And I think right now prison conditions are only poised to get worse as they continue to be overcrowded, as children are held, continue to be held without charges, without trial, and as the genocide in Gaza continues.
Yeah, I've read many examples of when it can be a child, it can be an adult. They're released from prison, and either the parents or the spouse hardly can recognize them anymore. I mean, that's how much the body has degraded, how much weight's been lost. I wanted to reference an opinion piece by Mariam Barghouti. And this is not about children specifically, but this was from June 1st. This was in Drop Site News, June 1st of this year, the deadliest period in history for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli detention. That's the headline.
Absolutely.
And she says, after October 7th, and we should mention that after October 7th, this is when Itamar Ben-Gvir authorize the conditions to get far worse, and we can talk about that. But the subtitle reads, after October 7th, 2023, prisoners' conditions and abuse inside all Israeli detention centers have dramatically worsened, resulting in at least 70 deaths. Again, this is as of June 1st, as a result of torture by Israeli interrogators or prison units, systemic starvation, or medical negligence through the deliberate denial of medical care. And I'll quote one more line. According to prisoner rights groups, dozens more have been killed in detention, particularly those arrested from Gaza, yet remain unidentified. Israel refuses to provide a comprehensive list of all detained Palestinians, with significant numbers forcibly disappeared and their whereabouts or condition unknown.
Yeah, I'll say obviously Miriam's piece, I think, I'm sure gives a much more thorough overview, but since October 7th, there have been many Palestinian prisoners who have died in Israeli custody. Part of me was surprised it took so long for a child to die, given that children are, subject to the same experiences, the same starvation, the same torture as adults in Israeli prisons. I will talk a little bit about the situation of children who have been detained from Gaza because they are not necessarily kept in the Israeli prison system and so aren't under the same system of administrative detention or this types of data. So we've documented a number of cases where children were taken by Israeli soldiers, transported out of Gaza to Sde Tayman, which is an Israeli military base located in southern Israel that has essentially been turned into a torture camp where children and adults, I'll often say that Israeli forces view any Palestinian boy old enough to start growing a mustache as a potential combatant. So we know that they treat children, young teenage boys, as potential combatants. And so they've been essentially disappeared to Sde Tayman or other detention centers that were, again, there's no visibility into how many Palestinians are in these locations, who they are, what their conditions are, if they have any charges at all. But the few reports we have been able to document show really unmatched levels of torture that, we have not seen in the West Bank. Sde Tayman, where a couple weeks ago we documented the case of a 16-year-old boy named Omar who had been taken from Khan Yunis and kept in Sde Tayman for about a month. He was forced to kneel all the time, all day, during his interrogation, which lasted many days. For part of it, he was put into what they called the disco room for a few days, where there's really loud music, really designed to really upset the detainee and really cause psychosis. In Omar's case, he was dangled upside down off the side of a building. His feet were tied up and he was dangled off the side of a building. And then the interrogator dropped the rope and he fell about five stories until he was just, he said, about 20 inches off the ground. And the interrogator left him there for like 20 minutes. I say this and it's very upsetting, but I really need to emphasize that these are not methods that we saw prior to October 7th. The Israeli government, I think, really has taken it upon themselves to undo any guardrails there were prior to October 7th to protect prisoners. And not that there were many to begin with, to be clear, but as an organization, we've been documenting the experience of children in detention for a long time. And so we have data that goes pretty far back in terms of how often a child is put into solitary confinement, how often a child is blindfolded, things like this. And the types of torture we're seeing unleashed on children from Gaza and really the huge blackout on information and access to prisons and detention centers is really frightening. I say that because we have been documenting these issues for so long that we know what Israeli guards and what Israeli soldiers do to children when they let people see it. And now they're not letting anybody see it. They're not letting anybody into these torture camps in Gaza. And so we've seen Israeli soldiers do really horrendous acts of torture to children prior to October 7th. And those were things we were allowed, in a sense, to witness and to document. And so now to think that there is a complete blackout on that information and then there's no access, I think is really frightening. And I think the only way it will stop is if huge numbers of elected officials from other countries show up and say, hey, I want to go in there and I want you to show me what's happening.
International law says that the International Committee of the Red Cross is supposed to have access,
Right.
and they do not. This is the same kind of black hole that existed at Abu Ghraib, at Guantanamo, especially with Itamar Ben-Gvir having the powerful position of National Minister of Security, which is in charge of the prisons, and going out of his way to make the conditions subhuman and not allowing any access. We can only imagine. I mean, we're hearing what Miranda is saying, but it in all likelihood is even worse than what you're saying, because we don't even know,
except
from testimonials from the what I'll call hostages themselves.
Mm.
There are a lot of articles linked at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist at tangents.com. Thank you, Harry, for posting them. Just go to tangents.com, go in the left-hand column, and click on the Tangents playlist and scroll down, and you will see a number of articles that have testimonials from people who have been tortured in the most horrific ways possible. And I suggest, if you're interested, to take the time to look that up. I want to mention one thing, which is not related, but certainly important. I read yesterday that Dropsite News is supporting a Gaza journalist fund. You know about this? No, okay. It's supporting journalists evacuating Gaza City in order to help them survive displacement to the south. This past Tuesday, which was the 9th of September, Israel ordered 1 million residents of Gaza City to evacuate. I mean, it really seems like something which a couple of years ago was a fantasy of messianic settlers is now looking like it could become reality, where Palestinians who live in Gaza are completely ethnically cleansed from Gaza so that either these messianic settlers can reoccupy it, or I don't know what Trump and Netanyahu have in mind. But the plan right now is ongoing to completely occupy, first destroy, ethnically cleanse, and fully occupy Gaza City, the biggest and most populous city in Gaza. And what this fund does is it's in partnership with Unmute Humanity, and Dropsite is raising funds for 29 journalists to support their survival and continued coverage. So there is a graphic at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist with a link for this Gaza Journalist Fund. And Miranda, you know, as well as anyone, that this has been the deadliest period for journalists in modern history, because they're not just being killed. What was that? What's that sick phrase?
Collateral damage?
Yeah. It's not collateral damage. It's actual targeting and assassinations. And recently, the entire Al Jazeera media crew was assassinated, the one dedicated to Gaza City. So you were talking, Miranda, about not being able to have access to really see what's going on in the prisons. Israel is taking it fully so that no eyes can report on what's happening in Gaza, and in this case, in Gaza City. Thank you so, so very much for making the time, Miranda. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. This was nice, and I really appreciate the invitation.
That's Miranda Cleland, the advocacy officer, one of two advocacy officers. The other one in London, she's based in Washington, D.C., for Defense for Children International Palestine. The website is dci-palestine.org.